From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Right now, the country and the world is discussing whether America will elect its first black president. But some people believe the event has already happened. Over time, rumor mongers and amateur historians have claimed that Andrew Jackson, Thomas Jefferson, Warren Harding, Dwight Eisenhower, Calvin Coolidge, and Abraham Lincoln had black blood. No one's been able to prove any of this, but today we'll look at why these claims exist and persist. What does this conversation tell us about America's racial attitudes, culture, and history, and what would it really take to examine the rumors to see if they're true? With us today, Beverly Gage, an assistant professor of history at Yale University, and Edward Ball. He's the author of several books, including the award-winning Slaves in the Family. His latest book is The Genetic Strand, Exploring a Family History Through DNA. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
So, Beverly, let me start with you. You wrote in the New York Times Magazine about Warren Harding and the rumors that he had black ancestors. So if that were true, prevailing racial views would have defined him as black. So tell us a little bit more about what people were saying at the time and why.
Absolutely. Warren Harding, really, even before he ran for president, from the moment that he entered political office, in local Ohio politics, was dogged by rumors that he had black ancestors. And the rumors varied. Some of the rumors focused on the idea that his great-grandmother had been a fugitive slave or had been black. Others focused on his father. Others focused on other members of the family. But the rumors themselves were fairly persistent, and they were fairly widely accepted, especially among Harding's opponents, but even according to rumor, among the communities that Harding lived in as a young man. And there's a suggestion, in fact, that Harding's whole family was understood to be black but passing in the small communities where they grew up. And so when Harding became president, as he was campaigning for president in 1920, these rumors reached a sort of fever pitch, and they were laid out in particular by a historian named William Estabrook Chancellor, who wrote what is now a fairly notorious and extremely hard-to-find book about these allegations about Harding's mixed-race ancestry.
Now, so much of this has to do with whether people see blackness as a negative in general or a political negative. Just in the 2000 presidential campaign, people started a whisper campaign claiming that Senator John McCain had an illegitimate black child. They were talking about his daughter, who's Bangladeshi by birth, and he and his wife adopted her. And so that gives a sense of kind of how these issues even persist today. But let's go back to Warren Harding's era. If people at that time proved that he was part black, how would it have affected his political career and his social standing?
Right. Well, certainly the one-drop rule was in effect. And one of the reasons that these rumors were kept alive and one of the reasons that this Professor Chancellor wrote his book was that they hoped that even the merest suggestion of having, quote-unquote, Negro blood in him would invalidate the Harding presidency. There were actually, interestingly, suggestions that that Republicans, and Harding was a Republican, Republicans were then the party of civil rights, the party of Lincoln still, and there were actually a few suggestions that it was actually the Republicans who were spreading these rumors in order to take advantage of the black vote in the North, because you'd had a big movement of African Americans from the South to northern cities during the First World War. But by far, the greater emphasis was on how much damage this could do to Harding's candidacy. And in fact, Harding himself hit back pretty hard against those who raised these rumors and against Chancellor in particular. Chancellor ended up being run out of the country, forced up to Canada, and most of the copies of his book were destroyed, many of them burned. And so they're very hard to find now, but that was the context. And the other thing I think that's important to remember at this moment in the teens and the 20s was that this was really the height of post-Civil War racial violence. You had Jim Crow being instituted in the South and being often enforced through violence. The Klan is on the rise by 1915, certainly into the 1920s. One of the interesting things about the Harding presidency, you know, if we want to think, was he actually our first black president, is that it was also the heyday of the second rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the early 20s. So really pretty vicious racial politics shaping all of these issues.
Edward, let me turn to you. Now, you're research on racial mixing among your own ancestors helped shape a public debate on how race connects us, and Slaves in the Family showed these secret connections between blacks and whites in your own family. But on the issue of President Harding, there's a often repeated but not verified story that a friend asked him whether he was part black, and President Harding reportedly said, "How do I know, Jim? One of my ancestors might have jumped the fence." So when you think about this whole idea of jumping the fence or passing for white, how common was that?
It was probably less common than people would say today. I think that it might have involved 50,000 African Americans over a period of 1900 to 1930 who crossed the line and lived white. That was an option, especially as Jim Crow became more ferocious. People would leave the South as black people and end up in New York or Chicago and begin to live white and pass themselves as Italian Americans or Greek Americans. And that was something that black families back home, back in the South, respected by and large, and allowed their brothers and cousins to maintain.
Well, let's talk about another historical example. Thomas Jefferson had children with his slave, Sally Hemings, and many historians refused to believe that these rumors were true until DNA proved it true. Your new book is about race, family, and genetics. So do you think that genetics, it's highly unlikely that someone's going to dig up Warren Harding, but if there were the chance to exhume some of these past presidents, do you think that genetic testing would be one way of trying to establish whose ancestry was what?
Yes, it would be possible to do that. You can extract DNA from bone fragments, assuming they survived, and also from hair, which survives almost as long as bones. Bone is porous, which means it sucks in the sweat from people touching it, which contains DNA, so you have to be careful about contamination. You would put the bone through an extraction process, and some labs specialized in so-called ancient DNA, and then you would look for markers on the DNA associated with West African populations. Different data exists and different markers that signal genes that traveled from their root continent, in this case Africa, and you may get just bits of the DNA molecule, and you would look in those bits and hope that the markers that you want are on those bits. This is this was done successfully in the case of the family of the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, who was killed by the Bolsheviks in 1919, and whose family, the bones of which were exhumed in the 1990s and tested for DNA comparison with distant relatives in the UK, and geneticists were able to confirm that the remains were then what they were purported to be.
Beverly, let me turn back to you. Your article is not the first work to raise these questions. It's been written up in Afrocentric history books, including a 1965 book by J.A. Rogers called The Five Negro Presidents. There's a similar book called Six Black Presidents, Black Blood, White Masks. So why would these authors want to claim white presidents as their own?
Right. Well, this is a great question. I mean, one of the really interesting things is just how long these rumors have persisted. And what's particularly interesting in Harding's case is, why anyone would necessarily want to claim Warren Harding in particular, who is usually on our pretty low down on the list of presidential rankings. But I think more broadly, it raises this question of kind of a pride or an inclusion question. And I think it's sort of an open question. What is at stake by claiming someone like Harding as black? I think in the most basic way, it is a suggestion that, first of all, we don't yet know the truth about race in America, either today necessarily, or certainly we haven't fully come to terms with all of the truth about our racial past. One of the things that's most interesting is why we don't know this, right? Why it's been so difficult to ferret out this truth. And then as well, I think, to claim someone like Harding as black, or to even raise the possibility that he might have been, just suggests that You know, black people are not kind of the great exception in American history, American political history, but have been part of everything from the presidency on. And so I think that's part of the impulse anyway.
Ed, when you think about the impact that your work has had in terms of contextualizing the connections between blacks and whites in America, what do you think of this whole debate and why people are interested in it, you know, in terms of the presidency and blackness and whiteness?
Well, as you know, people are perennially fascinated by interracial sex, and which has its roots in and forced sexual relationships on the plantations during the slave days. And this this kind of electricity, the electricity around this subject seems to persist right down to the present. And this the business about Harding is, I think, another manifestation of it. But what Beverly says about the community being the source of the rumors and possibly authenticating them based upon their source in the towns where Harding grew up is pretty right on. For example, in South Carolina, black people in the state knew about Strom Thurmond's black daughter for 50 years. And when she finally stepped forward, the only people that were surprised were those in the white community, because most black South Carolinians knew all about it. There's another way to try to authenticate or check the rumor, which was used in the Sally Hemings case, and that would be to test the male descendants of Harding's grandfather, who I think was one of the people who was said to look black, to test the white and black descendants if they're willing to do so.
You know, we have to stop, but that would be an interesting thing. If there are any Warren Harding relatives out there who would like to come on the show and provide some DNA, we are here and waiting. Beverly and Ed, have to let you go. Thank you so much. Beverly Gage, Assistant Professor of History at Yale University, and author Edward Ball, Slaves in the Family and the Genetic Strand. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Now we turn to Southern Africa and the latest on the crisis in Zimbabwe. On Monday, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai pulled out of the country's upcoming presidential runoff election. Tsvangirai's decision comes after weeks of intimidation and violence directed at him and his supporters. He blames President Robert Mugabe and his ruling ZANU-PF party. Zimbabwean election officials say the second round of voting will still go ahead on Friday as planned. On the phone from Harare is Cleaver Berry. He's the president of Zimbabwe's National Student Union. Cleaver, how are you?
Okay, how are you? Thank you very much.
Cleaver, does your organization support Morgan Tsvangirai and the Movement for Democratic Change's decision to drop out of the runoff election?
The Zimbabwe National Students Union position is that the position that has been taken by President Morgan Tsvangirai and MDC to pull out of the March of the June 27 runoff is the only logical decision they could make given the circumstances. So the position of the students' movement is that what Mr. Tsvangirai and MDC did was actually correct.
But don't you think that essentially this decision means that President Mugabe will be in power indefinitely?
Well, the challenge that Mugabe will have is that the little legitimacy that he had has been eroded, and it is going to be difficult for him to rule, especially with African leaders now coming up and strongly against what he has been doing. But I think the most important to the people of Zimbabwe and also to the MDC and to President Tsvangirai is, what measures do we have, which plan do we have as plan B to make sure that eventually the people of Zimbabwe will achieve what they've been fighting for, that is democracy and a better living, a better life. And one of the things that we'll propose as the students' movement is probably to have a process of a transitional authority that will facilitate a fresh election in the shortest possible time.
Tell me about your student union. What kind of an organization is it?
Well, the Zimbabwe National Students Union is a union representing just over 300,000 students from tertiary institutions in Zimbabwe. And the number of tertiary institutions that affiliate to ZINASU is 44, meaning that the 44 institutions they are heads, that is their presidents, sits in the General Council of ZINASU, which meets after every 2 months. And there is also the National Executive Council that is elected at Congress, which sits biannually.
What is it like right now in Harare? You know, I've been there many times, and last time I was there was 15 months ago, and actually a little bit more, more like 18 months ago. And Harare was already experiencing so much in terms of shortages of food, cooking oil, you know, any kind of supplies. What's going on the day-to-day in terms of how people are living?
I think the major difference from the time you were here is that then we were experiencing shortages. But as we speak right now, there is nothing on the shop shelves. People are actually surviving on imports. That is, the food that the people are surviving in are direct imports by the citizens themselves from South Africa, from Botswana. And most of the families are actually surviving from their kids who seek economic refuge in those countries. And given the xenophobic attacks in South Africa, indeed, there has been that has affected the livelihoods of the people of Zimbabwe. They, as we speak, especially with the banning of food distribution by NGOs, Zimbabwe is heading towards Somalia. People will starve of hunger. There is no food for the people to buy even in the shops, even if the people don't have money. But if they have the money, there is nothing to buy.
Do you plan to vote even though the MDC has dropped out on Friday?
Well, voting on Friday means I will be legitimizing an illegitimate process. I will be saying what, even if I don't vote for Mugabe, but the outcome of that election will be a reflection of the people of Zimbabwe.
Are you hopeful that someone, I mean, the UN Security Council has heard arguments from the U.S. and Britain, different countries and coalitions of African leaders have tried to make statements, but statements have not so far changed things. What would help?
To say I'm hopeful or not, I think the obvious answer is yes, I'm, and students of Zimbabwe are still very hopeful. But we are calling on President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, who has been mandated by SADC to mediate in the Zimbabwean crisis, to look seriously into the issue and move away from his quiet diplomacy, which is not producing the desired results. And probably as the AU summit sits on Saturday, we urge the African leaders to take a position on Zimbabwe. The deployment of a peacekeeping mission, it is now long overdue. The people of Zimbabwe have suffered enough.
Cleaver, I want to thank you so much for talking to us.
You are welcome. Thank you very much.
Cleaver Berry is president of Zimbabwe's National Student Union. He spoke with us from Harare, Zimbabwe. And now we're going to move on to our broader Africa update. We'll look at upcoming elections in the Comoros Islands and why South Africa says Chinese residents can now call themselves black. For more, we've got Cassandra Walden. She's Chief of External Communications at the United Nations Development Program. Hey, Cassandra.
Hi, Farai. Great to be with you.
Always great to have you on. And let's actually start with another issue, which is the global food crisis. Africa's second most populous country, Ethiopia, is asking for emergency food aid. The government says more than 4.5 million people are in desperate need of help because of a drought which struck most of the country earlier this year. So, Cassandra, what makes this food crisis different from past ones?
Well, I think this one is even exacerbated by the crisis with higher food prices that we've seen across the globe. We see in Ethiopia that you have children, as many as 75,000 kids, who are already acutely malnourished, now finding themselves deteriorating even further because of the drought and the lack of food that is available to them. We see that seasonal rains in Ethiopia have failed completely or are very poor in many parts of Ethiopia. And this is really hurting crop production. It means that farmers can't take care of their livestock. It is just a very devastating situation.
So when you look at Ethiopia, it is not the only nation which is dealing with a food crisis issue. Put it in context for us, what Ethiopia is dealing with compared to some of the other African nations.
Absolutely. Well, if your listening audience can think about the things that we face on a daily basis, maybe we choose not to go out to a restaurant because prices are going too high. We change what we buy at the grocery store. But here we're talking about people's survival. The fact that people are having to make hard decisions about what they can feed their families and make choices about how they can use their meager resources. And some of them don't even have the power to do that. They're already so weak or so malnourished or so ill that their systems are really deteriorating quite severely. So we see across the continent a number of, over the past couple of months, riots due to the food prices, people really finding themselves slipping deeper into poverty instead of being able to pull themselves out. And as you know, this is one of the things that I feel and my organization feels very strongly about. We cannot allow these countries to slip further into poverty.
So give me a couple of more nations that are really dealing with this issue, and then also what's the response from the international community?
Absolutely. Well, one of the countries that I know you follow very closely, Zimbabwe, which is on the radar screen of a lot of the media these days because of the electoral situation there. We know that about a third of Zimbabwe's population is currently being assisted in terms of food aid because they just don't have anything to eat and they need ongoing assistance. Countries like Mozambique, several West African countries have seen major issues with food price increase. And people just in the streets, upset about it, unable to make their way in terms of being able to feed their families and being able to live a decent life. So we know that agriculture in Africa is something that the international community, African governments need to invest in quite a bit more. We know that despite the fact that Africa does have a number of challenges that it's facing on the agricultural sector, if we invest in agriculture and begin to encourage and help farmers produce more, we can really build up food security in the continent.
I want to move to another part of the continent, one that I personally know very little about, the Comoros Islands. Tell us where it is and then, you know, a little bit about some upcoming elections there.
Absolutely. Well, the Comoros story is one that I love. It's one of the most interesting stories, I think, coming out of the continent this month because it's an off-the-beaten-path country. Made up of three islands. And here we're talking about the island of Anjouan, which is where these elections will take place on the 29th of June. This is an Indian Ocean country, which has over the past 25 years or so, since 1975, been the subject of about 20 coup attempts or successful coups. That's extraordinary. So there's been a lot of instability. The first round of the elections for the president of Anjouan were held on the 15th of June, quite successfully and in a transparent fashion. The two lead candidates are now going for a runoff election on the 29th of June. And if this island can pull this election off, we believe that the country stands in good stead to begin to move towards stability. This particular island had in the 1990s been heavily involved in a separatist movement. There's been a lot of unrest there over the last few months. So the hope is that this election will go off smoothly, that there will be a clear winner, that people will go to the polls, and that then the country can look towards its future. What's really interesting about the way Comoros is set up is that each island, each of the three islands, has its own president. And then there is a president of the union, and that brings within itself some real challenges. And this is a setup that was established in 2001 to try to bring the three islands together as a united country. So I'm very excited about it and hoping that it will go off peacefully and constructively with the support of the international community, and then that this country might begin to look at the issues of poverty and some of the challenges that it faces in terms of the way that its people are forced to live, because they have not been able to attract investment, haven't been able to attract the attention of the international community because of the lack of stability over so many, many years.
So the United Nations is sending people to observe the election. When UN observers go to the site of an election, what do they actually do?
What they're looking at is how people are enabled to get to the polls, whether their documentation is handled appropriately, ensuring that people are allowed access to the polls in an unfettered fashion.
There's always something fascinating going on in the world, and this one is definitely fascinating. So The High Court in South Africa ruled that Chinese South Africans will now be reclassified as black people so they can get employment and other economic benefits from the government. Now, there's about 200,000 ethnic Chinese living in South Africa. Give me a little more detail, because obviously South Africa has had so many issues with racial classification. What's really going on here?
I think the way you can characterize it is really to say that during the apartheid era, there were many groups that were discriminated against, as we all watched from afar. And the Chinese who were in South Africa prior to 1994 fell into that category. And the recent court decision simply is allowing them to take advantage of affirmative action opportunities such as the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, which is really meant to give opportunities to open employment and other windows to those who were disadvantaged during the apartheid era. In this case, we're talking about the Chinese, and certainly it's a very volatile issue, but we know that it's important to find ways to include minorities in society, and we know that South Africa's facing some other challenges, as we've all seen from the news over the past several weeks. Earlier this year, there were xenophobic attacks with some 60 people killed and tens of thousands of foreigners left homeless. So these are issues that people feel very closely to their hearts, and we know that there needs to be an effort to really bring everybody in and be inclusive. And, in South Africa, the United Nations working very closely with the government and with a number of other partners to try to assist those foreigners who have been left homeless by the violence, to try to ensure that society can be welcoming to all which are within its borders, and to look out for ways to protect those who might be at risk.
Well, Cassandra, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Farai. Always good to be with you.
Cassandra Walden is Chief of External Communications at the United Nations Development Program, and she was at our New York studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Let's move on to some Trivial Pursuits. Did Gregory Hines, Alvin Ailey, Langston Hughes, or Catherine Dunham create a famous dance company in New York? What was Jesse Jackson's birth name? Which member of the group In Vogue was crowned Miss Black California? Those are some questions from a new DVD game called Are You Sure? Maryland high school teacher Daryl Penn invented the game because he found games like Family Feud or Trivial Pursuit didn't highlight African American history and culture. Daryl's with us now. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So what gave you the idea for the game?
Well, I went to my sister had a get together. There were six African American couples who were playing games, and one game in particular, we were playing Family Feud. And the question was, name a street that's in every American city. And like, I knew that the answer was MLK, because every city has a Martin Luther King. You know, it was a done deal. We're talking trash to the other team. And that wasn't even listed as one of the options. And there were five options. So after that question, it just had me thinking, well, maybe there's another game that I could bring to the next get-together. So I went to Toys R Us, Walmart, Target. I went online, and I couldn't find it. So since I said I couldn't find it, I decided to create it.
Tell us how the game is played. Like, what is it like? What, you know, what happens? What kind of teams?
Okay. Well, the game starts with you start with two teams. Three rounds are played. As the rounds go, as the rounds progress, the questions get harder and the points increase. Periodically, you know, a question will be answered and a video will pop up, and the person on the video will say, "Are you sure?" And they'll give them the opportunity to change their answer. And at the end of the game, whoever has the most points, that's the team that wins.
Okay, I'm going to put myself out here as a sacrificial lamb. I understand you brought some questions. I got an email from a listener once who said, when I failed a trivia question earlier, said, "I expected more from you." So I'm just going to put myself out. Ask me a question.
Okay, I'll be nice. Everybody Hates Chris star Terry Crews was drafted by what NFL team? Now, you have four options. Let me give those to you. The Redskins, the Eagles, the Chargers, or the Rams?
Oh, man, I am laughing here because I am so sports illiterate. I have no clue. I cannot even guess. But I will say that I was on the dance floor with Terry Crews last night at one of the BET wow. parties, and he knows how to move, and so does his wife. But I'm completely, I'll say the Redskins. I don't know.
Okay, well, it was the Rams.
Okay.
So you were close. They both start with an R.
I don't know if I'd get points for that in the game. All right, let's do one more.
Okay, I'll give you an easy one. How many Kwanzaa principles are there?
Seven.
And there you go.
Thank goodness. Don't ask me to name all of them. But Nia, that's one. We actually, that was, you know, we had a little whole Kwanzaa quiz on our air before. I was not the one doing it. But let's put it this way. A lot of people failed. So what are you really hoping to accomplish with this game? You know, what do you want besides people having fun?
For me, like with my family, we played a lot of games growing up, and we still play a lot of games together. I just look at it as a bonding tool. Like, I worked as I'm a teacher, but I was the advisor for a mentorship group for young men. And we would talk all the time, and they would say a lot of times that they didn't spend time with their families. Like, when they went home, you know, they'd be in their room. Their sister might be in the other room. You know, the parents are somewhere else. This is something that can bring the entire family into the same place and kind of put them on equal footing. Because the way the questions were created, it's not like I'm 38, but the questions don't all pertain to my era. So like for my team, if I was playing for my team to be successful, it'd be a good idea for me to get someone that's maybe 16, maybe someone that's 59. So, you know, no matter what the question is, we kind of have someone that's in that era. So that's kind of the purpose, just to bond families.
You got students involved in this. Tell me about that.
That was just students are what I did. I picked students that I've had in class before. I'm a business education teacher. So I made sure they were students that really were comfortable with the computer and they could get the information that I needed. So I really just gave them, I rented my classroom out for, actually I did it for two Saturdays, and I had five students come in each time, and I just gave them topics that I wanted questions about. And then I just had one or two of those students verify the information, and then I went back over and I verified it as well.
You've got a company now called Jornick DVD Games. What are your plans in terms of the company? Are you going to try to put out more titles?
Absolutely. After I'm looking at putting out one more title before the Christmas holiday, but I haven't decided. I'm looking at a couple, but I haven't made a decision yet.
You're still going to teach, and you're going to try to design more games. Are you afraid that, you know, are you afraid of losing your shirt in business? Because, you know, there's nothing guaranteed.
Well, sometimes you have to take a chance, but I'm not going to spend $1 million to create the game. You know, I'm taking things slowly. that for me, that's kind of one of the things that I've seen people in the past, and my degree's in business, and people that some companies that go under is because they try to get too big too fast. So I'm taking things slowly.
What's the best compliment you've ever heard from anyone who's played the game?
Well, I had students play it, and they didn't know that I created the game. And the biggest compliment was it wasn't long enough. And that lets me know they wanted to keep playing, they enjoyed it, and it, you know, that made me feel good.
Absolutely. Daryl, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daryl Penn is a business teacher at Old Mill High School in Millersville, Maryland. He's also the creator of the new DVD game, Are You Sure? He joined us from the studios of the Baltimore Sun in Baltimore, Maryland.
Don't you wanna come to Georgia? Don't you wanna come to Georgia? Don't you wanna come to Georgia? Don't you wanna come to Georgia?
The city of Hotlanta has given us R&B and hip-hop artists from Babyface and TLC to Lil Jon and Ludacris. Now coming up in the ranks is Georgia native Anthony David. Originally from Savannah, Anthony has spent his whole life writing songs. But it wasn't until he moved to Atlanta that he got serious about music as a career. It may have helped that the very first person he met in Atlanta while getting out of his car was none other than India Iree. Anthony wrote the song Part of My Life on India Iree's Grammy-nominated album Acoustic Soul. He also co-wrote and produced her R&B hit There's Hope. Now India Iree has chosen to make Anthony David's album the first one she's released on her new record label, Soulbird Music. Anthony's album is called AC Deucey. Hey, Anthony, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, you know, you have gotten some great reviews. The Atlanta Voice said your music is like walking barefoot on your mama's South Georgia land or sliding
nice.
$3 to the brothers on the corner. So I'm going to let you describe your sound. How is it? What is it?
In short, we call it Millennium Blues, and it's just because my foundation is the foundation of all of our music is blues, really. And I tend to creep a little bit more of that back into what we call R&B these days.
What do you think about the whole term neo-soul? Because music always transcends labels, but neo-soul has become one of those labels. What do you think of that and as a term, and would you ever put yourself under that umbrella?
Yeah, I consider that kind of the base of where I come from, because that's kind of my era of starting music. I don't mind the title so much. I think it was pretty accurate, you know, in what it was trying to do. And I don't have a problem much with titles, period, because they just are introductions to things. And some people transcend their titles. That's what I'm hoping to do.
You got to understand that women don't like to play. She just can't cut off her emotions in the same way. Don't be surprised when she's blowing you up on the phone.
Tell me how you got into music. How old were you when you first started playing an instrument, and what was it?
I was 23 when I started playing guitar. And I always wrote. And then I got into singing a little bit. And then I really got into it when I started writing songs, which was when I started playing guitar. It was like I found a voice when I was able to write.
That's, you know, compared to a lot of the folks we talked to who started playing when they were little kids, 23 is late. It's certainly not old, but it's, did you ever feel like, because you came out of more of a lyricist background, were you ever afraid of starting to play an instrument?
No, I just didn't really think much about it. It was just something that kind of came, and it was such a great tool as it for me on a personal basis. I really wasn't worried about, I guess, how it would have look to anybody else, you know what I mean? I just was enjoying it.
Now you get to work with folks like India Iree, and you guys have this duet on the album called Words, and that's been really popular. So how did you two connect?
Actually, before we both started playing and singing professionally or casually, she was singing. I was singing a little bit, but we were scared to show each other. I met her when I moved to Atlanta, and we just hung out all the time. And we actually started and made our pact and got into music locally together.
But I know that the end of the rainbow, yeah, no matter
Would you say that it has been an easy journey for you to reach the point where you have commercial success? I mean, how has it been for you?
Some parts easy, some parts hard. You know, I've done two independent records, and that was, you know, that was a long road. Like, you know, I did, the first one came out in 2004. So I've been, you know, on the road doing that for the last 4 years, and every, you know, that's not always easy. But it's been rewarding, you know, and I guess considering how long it took me to learn and start writing songs with the guitar, in some ways, relative to other people, it's easy. Sometimes relative to other people, it's hard. To others, anyway.
You have a great cover on the album, Something About You, by, you know, it was originally from the English band Level 42, came out,
yes,
you know, in 1985. I think a lot of people will really love hearing that. But you also have this side where you served in Desert Storm and jumped out of planes. Yeah. So how do you reconcile the side of you that has been, you know, super hardcore, you know, military guy with, you know, somebody who can sing such a mellow song?
That's just me. You know what I mean? That's just me. I guess it's one of those things where I'm a believer in the thing that where whatever, I guess, challenge comes your way, you can rise to it. So when that other thing happened with Desert Storm and whatnot, you know, I shocked myself and was able, and being in the Army, period, it was just something that, you know, I followed my dad into anyway. And I believe that's the kind of irony that is human anyway. Making mistakes is a part of life's imperfections. One of the years, it's not so wrong to be human after all.
When you joined the military, was it before Desert Storm and then you just were in a war situation, or did you join when Desert Storm was happening?
It was before. I joined in 89, like September 89. Yeah, I really, part of my rationale too was, you know, well, there haven't been any wars. I don't think they fight like that anymore. And then as soon as I got into my unit, about 3 months after I got to my unit, it was like alert.
Wow.
And I'm like, where's Iraq? Who's Saddam Hussein? What is this? I was like 18.
Yeah, oh my gosh, man, that must have been something. Did you sing while you were there?
That's where I really started. Like, I sang on tapes and stuff like that. I had this girl I liked that I would send her stuff. And then she told me it was good. That's where I got heavy into it and started liking it.
You've talked in some of your songs about social issues like gentrification. So we were in Atlanta not too long ago doing some live shows from Atlanta. What do you think is happening in Atlanta in terms of gentrification?
Well, just like in every city, there's the good part of making the city look better. People moving back in the city, obviously, with gas prices, is like more of a central thing. Atlanta's in real trouble when it comes to that anyway. It's all spread out. But then some of the character that made the city what it is, as far as the people and whatnot, you know, some things get pushed out instead of reformed. And, you know, so there's this like torn aspect to it. Edgewood Avenue down in Atlanta, Georgia. They're building a brand spanking new high rise. Used to be a crack spot, other side of the track spot. I hear them say it needs to be gentrified. They say that the people down here are worthless, and they just need to be swept away.
What does your family think about what you've done?
They're proud, you know, as long as I can eat, basically, that's all they care about. You know what I mean? And but they do like the art, you know, and my mom's always been a big supporter of it. And so she's happy to see the things that I wanted to do, I was able to make happen.
And what about settling down? Are you,
And as far as relationship and all that, well, I'm engaged now. I'm actually just becoming, I've been in a relationship for a good while now, and it's been long distance, and so we're pulling that together. Got a really great lady, I do.
Oh, congratulations. And Anthony, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anthony David's new album, AC Deucey, was released today. He spoke with us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
A woman came and changed the game. Changed the game. Changed the game. Happy that I found my lady. And my life will never be the same. Oh, yeah.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.